Hey, how you doing? And welcome back to another episode of The Rules of Investing, a podcast that gets inside the minds of leading investors, economists, and industry experts, brought to you by LiveWire Markets. I'm Ali Selvey, and in the last episode, we learnt about some of the major innovations happening in the ETF market with Tamara Haven-Bierstadt from BlackRock. This week, we're taking a deep dive into the wonderful world of growth investments, artificial intelligence, and holy grail stocks. Until recently, our guest was a bit of an AI skeptic, but a recent trip to the US has seen him come back a changed man. Today's guest is LiveWire reader favorite and investment advisor, Ben Clark. His firm, TMS Capital, has been running for 20 years now. When they started out, Ben and his team managed just $13 million in direct equities for less than a handful of clients. Today, the group has hit close to $1 billion in funds under management and now invests directly across a variety of asset classes. Today, we'll be learning why Ben is feeling bullish, as well as some of the major learnings he took away from his recent US trip to the South by Southwest conference. Plus, for something new, he'll be sharing some insights on the fixed income investments he's using to bolster investors' portfolios. If you're an Apple Podcast or Spotify user, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. Or if you're a LiveWire subscriber, hit the follow button at the bottom of the wire to be notified when episodes are available. Not a LiveWire subscriber yet? What are you doing? Head over to livewiremarkets.com. It's free, easy to register, and you'll get access to insights from leading investment minds in the country. Okay, let's get on with the show. Thank you so much for coming on The Rules of Investing, Ben. So excited to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Ali. Thanks for having me.
It's obviously been a really surprisingly fantastic 6 months for markets, with many investors betting big on inflation cooling and a rate cut or a few at some point this year.
Yeah.
In your opinion, what can investors expect for the remainder of 2024?
Yeah, so look, it has been a strong start. I think a much clearer pattern's been coming out of America. You know, you can look at the ASX and sort of think we've had a really good run. It's probably, ASX is up at nearly 1,000 points since its low 6 months ago. You can also go back to pre-pandemic, and the market's only up about 10% over the last 4 years. So it's been patchy here. I feel like there's been a clearer pattern in America with what's coming out, and that's pushing our market ahead. Look, there's no doubt interest rates, inflation are still a big talking point. I do feel like just in recent weeks, recent months, the market's getting a little bit more sanguine about rates, and maybe that's not the, you know, the complete focus that it has been for the last two and a half years. You know, we saw a very strong non-farm payroll number out a week or so ago. And markets actually rallied on that, despite that seeing bond yields rising. And if you just take a step back, if I went back to the start of the year and thought, you know, the markets have pushed out rate cut expectations into the second half, bond yields, like longer term bond yields, are actually hitting year highs, I would have been surprised that the US market was still retesting all-time highs, but that's what it's doing. So Jerome Powell still seems confident, and he's just spoken at a Stanford University talk that inflation is on a clear path to 2%. It still feels like that rate cutting cycle is there. But I think for the rest of 2024, the volatility is going to be around when does it kick in, but more importantly, how big is it going to be? You know, where are rates going to come down to, and how quickly are they going to get down there? Because that'll be a big part for the equity market. And the second thing I would say is, coming out of the Australian reporting season and the US reporting season, we've continued to see EPS upgrades. So it's not just multiple expansion or the outlook for rates that's driving markets, it's also earnings. That seems to be coming back into play.
Okay. I want to talk about the US now. There's $4 trillion in money market funds today, up from $1 trillion since the pandemic hit.
Yep.
Does that money eventually need to find a home in equities markets, or can it stay in these funds with reasonable returns and little risk?
Yeah, it's a, like, so this is a chart that I saw about a month ago that really got my interest, because in America there is off the charts historically high levels of cash that pension funds, hedge funds, sovereign wealth funds are sitting on at the moment. As you said, the amount of cash has increased nearly $3 trillion US dollars in the last 4 years. And there's been two legs to that. The first leg was When the pandemic hit, a huge amount of money went straight into cash. Even though the returns were zero, because that's where rates got cut straight down to, that was just a safety move in hindsight. And that amount actually held, which is a bit surprising because we saw markets bounce back, but it wasn't from the deployment out of money market funds. And then when the Fed went on the rate hiking cycle, returns went through the roof and even more cash came in, and that's where we sit now. So if I look at the moment, it's actually a really bullish setup for equities, because in the last 12 months, we've actually seen net outflows out of US share market funds. So money's been coming out. I would say that's kind of fairly typical behavior in the early days of a bull market. A lot of people not believing it. You know, the market's got back to a level and they thought, right, I'll get some money out. So it brings back into play Jerome Powell, because if rates get cut at a reasonable clip and the returns that investors are earning in money market funds gets to around 3 to 3.5%, you are going to see a lot of money start to move into other asset classes. And it's not just going to be shares. It could be bonds. It could be PE. It could be venture capital. It could be all property, all sorts of stuff. But you think that the market will get net inflows on the back of that. So, you know, we're at a time when cash on the sidelines is at record highs in America. Equity market outflows have actually been occurring during a rising share market. So to me, that's quite a good setup. And if I'm looking out through 2024, I'd say we're due for a correction, and corrections are normal in bull markets, but typically they're short and sharp, and they're typically short and sharp, particularly when there's a lot of cash on the sideline.
Mm. Can the same be said for Aussie investors? Do we also have a lot of dry powder to put to work?
Yeah, well, look, anecdotally, it feels like there is quite a bit of cash on the sideline. I think it's not, and I don't have statistics on it, but because it's not as publicly available, some of that information, but I feel like there's cash there, but because the returns on our cash, you know, you might be able to get 4, 4.5% or something. It's much higher in America because of their rates. So it's probably a bit less attractive, but I certainly feel like there's cash, more cash there than there has been for some time. And you know, again, that's another reason to be fairly bullish on a market. If we start to get the rate cuts, which I'm kind of expecting will be less, severe than America's might be.
Are you seeing that bullish sentiment, I guess, trickle down to, you know, your everyday investors? What's the most common question you're hearing from your clients?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would say my take at it, and I'm going through, you know, sort of my review period where I'm going and seeing clients directly and just going through the 6-monthly process there. And I'd say that clients are fairly, well, not clients, but my feeling is that mum and dads are fairly cynical or wary about where the market has moved to. And, you know, I think on the back of that, like, what's a common question? A common question I've had recently is, you know, that the last few years have been very challenging in terms of we've had some really nasty events happening. We had a pandemic that closed down the planet. We've had the biggest conflict kick off in Europe since World War II. Mm. We've had the biggest conflict in the Middle East this century. We've had four of the five hottest years on the planet. Trump, the chaotic Passover. You know, there's been a lot of reasons to be fairly gloomy or just to feel maybe a bit negative about the outlook. But the point I make is that there's never been a time in human history where things have looked great, unfortunately. And I'm an optimist, and I would say, although, you know, there's some really awful things going on at the moment, but incrementally things are getting better from a macro point of view. But the share market, although it can be impacted in the short term by these breakouts of geopolitical events or war, or as we saw during the pandemic, ultimately, what the market does is measure the profitability of the businesses that are listed on the market. And many businesses' profits have not been affected by these events. So, you know, that's been a common question, I suppose, is why are markets rallying when there's so much doom and gloom in the world? And, you know, my unfortunate answer is that's fairly common. It's normal. And no one's ever there to wave a white flag and say, things look great. Now's the time to invest. You've got to take that path through a lot of things that will try you and worry you.
Yeah. Okay. I want to learn like what that means for portfolios a little bit later on.
Yeah.
But right now I want to talk about, I guess, the biggest theme that's really taking over the world right now, which is artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
You just came back from a trip in the US to South by Southwest. I know you told me that you thought that AI was a little overhyped before.
Yeah.
Have you come back a changed man?
Yeah, I think I have. And, you know, I think this trip that I was sort of, I knew that I'd pick up some things out of it. I wasn't sure how significant they'd be. You know, it really changed my thinking. So the premise of South by Southwest is the leaders of industries, and it's like a massively diverse blend of industries. So it might be someone in sports technology or the leading engineer who designs office buildings in the world. And they all fly into this event and they talk for 1 hour about where they see their industry headed. And so you're getting to hear the best and brightest minds talking about what they see coming. And artificial intelligence, I think, you know, it almost felt, you almost got weary of it by the end of the 5 days, but everyone was talking about that. And the thing I'd like that challenged my thinking was, A, I felt like, although, yes, this is going to be a big cycle, it's still some way off, and that's wrong. Like the cycle has already started and it's going to accelerate very rapidly over the next 2 years. And B, I think it's actually clear that this is the fourth super cycle in technology, and potentially it's going to be the most significant. So it's not like you're going to snap your fingers and say, AI has started. It already has started. If you talk into your phone when you're text messaging, that's AI. Or if you put into Google Maps how to get from here to there as quickly as possible, it's already using AI. So we're already interacting with it on a day-to-day basis as our companies, but it's going to rapidly scale and drive up. And, you know, I certainly came back feeling like I had underestimated what that path looks like.
Okay. You also met with a Google executive while you were over there. What was the main message you took away from that meeting?
Yeah, that was really interesting. So we met with an Australian who's working out of Austin and did a site tour of the Google office and had an hour with him in a boardroom. And I guess a few insights that I could pass on. One was, you know, he spoke very openly about the ChatGPT transaction that Microsoft did and, you know, said, the view is that this will be the most successful M&A transaction that's ever been done in history. Wow. Not just in terms of how much money it's going to make for Microsoft, but the genius of it, and this is a part I hadn't realized or thought about, was that what it's allowed Microsoft to do is to push through product releases, upgrades, updates through an unlisted vehicle that doesn't have ties effectively back to Microsoft. So if OpenAI put out a new program that's looking at a completely different area of AI and the machines hallucinate or you get something weird that comes out of it, Microsoft stock's not going to start getting shorted. OpenAI puts up its hands, they say, that didn't work, we're going to pull that back in-house and then we'll re-release it. And that's been the biggest thing. So what it's allowing them to do is to put these products out to market much faster than their competitors, and to get, you know, effectively its user uptake makes the machines learn and speed up, which gives them a lead over competitors. So, you know, I think the take was there, it was genius. And what it's led to, you know, with a company like Google, which, you know, had the release of Bard, now called Gemini, which was a bit of a disaster because there were some unusual things. But the same happened with OpenAI. It's just that Microsoft wasn't standing necessarily right behind it. So the feedback we got that was, you know, Google is internally testing their AI programs much longer and more significantly before they're putting them out to market. So, you know, as a Google, we own Google and Microsoft shares. And I was a little bit worried about Google, I would say, going over, just because it would feel like OpenAI has massively got the jump on them. But the feedback was that if you saw the pipeline that's internal that will be coming to market, it's extraordinary. And, you know, it was a reminder that Google employs 174,000 of the smartest people on the planet. It's going to spend $50 billion on AI alone this year. And it owns the world's entire search history. And so it already knows what we all want to know, and it knows what the answers are. And so there's a lot to come out of that, I think.
Okay. And off the back of that meeting, did you feel more bullish on the outlook for Microsoft or Google?
I think both are great to own. I mean, if I look at Microsoft in our little office, there's now seven of us subscribing to Copilot. Copilot costs more per year than Microsoft Office. So what's interesting is, you know, if you think back to when the internet was invented, which I think is kind of the last super cycle you can compare to this, it took a long time for those companies to actually monetize what they were doing. But now it's happening very rapidly. Like, you know, our little company is paying almost double to Microsoft than it was 6 months ago. And there will be millions of companies across the world that are doing that. And the same will happen for a lot of other businesses. The other thing, takeout I got out of it probably, Ali, was, you know, you can get caught in being an ASX investor or an Australian investor and think that you can try and find the AI winners on the ASX. And, you know, when you go and see the behemoths who are doing it, you come back and think, there are very, very few businesses in Australia that are going to get a trickle-down effect of AI spend.
Okay, we're going to talk about that in just a few questions' time. But first, last time you came on the podcast, you told us the faster the growth of a company, the more likely you are to be tested or squeezed by the market. I mean, we've seen the likes of NVIDIA and Google and Microsoft, Amazon, AMSL, Taiwan Semiconductor all see their share prices run over the last 12 months. Not as much as NVIDIA, though.
Hmm.
Would you be buying those businesses today if you didn't already own them, or is it too late?
Yeah, so I guess our approach is, you know, when we on a client-by-client basis, we feel there's an allocation that they should have to global investing. So if someone came and saw us and didn't have any exposure to global, we would absolutely recommend that they should have it and effectively be a buyer of it. For those that have already got the exposure, I feel like now's probably not the time, despite all the what I've just been saying. You know, these stocks have had a very strong run. Now's not the time that you want to be, you know, really falling in love with them. If you think back to 2022, and actually when I did the last podcast, it was literally at the peak of the last growth cycle. And although I would say in hindsight, little change with many businesses on the NASDAQ or in Australia on the ASX in that area of the market, massive drawdowns in prices happened. And it's a reminder that although these businesses, you know, have got incredible earnings growth and the outlooks are still very good, they have very solid pullbacks along the path. And you just need to keep that in mind when you're position sizing and those sort of things. But if I look, just last answer, if I look at, let's use Google as an example. Google is trading on a PE on next year's earnings of 20 times. It's got $180 billion in cash on its balance sheet and no debt. And it's on an EV to EBITDA of about 12, which would, you know, return on equity 25%. If it's not expensive, you know, by historical standards. And if I look at a lot of Australian growth stocks, it's significantly cheaper than most of them. And it's probably higher quality than most of them. So it's not like, I think you can make the mistake at looking at what the market's done and thinking, oh, they're all overvalued. The earnings have kept growing, which, and we've seen a big pull, you know, like Google is really back to where it was in 2021. It got to $150 in 2021. I think it's about 156 now. But it got down to $80 in between now and then. So position sizing, allocations, don't get in the trap of thinking just because things have run hard recently that if you're a long-term investor, there is still a really good reason you want to own businesses in this space.
Let's turn to the ASX now. You said before there's not actually that many businesses that really will benefit from this shift to AI.
Yeah.
What Aussie stocks actually do directly benefit?
Yeah. So I should split that up into two, because there will be a lot of businesses that do benefit. But what I mean there is, the way I see it playing out is that the first thing is there's going to be massive spend on AI. So that could be from people or it could be from companies that are looking to deploy software solutions to try and work out how they can improve their lives or their businesses using AI. And the companies that are providing those software solutions, etc., they're generally all offshore. There's very few here. So there might be a couple of names. I think the ones that get singled out here are probably the data storage players would be the main one. So, you know, you've got Macquarie Technology, Goodman Group, and NextDC would be the three. There's no doubt there will be a massive pull forward in demand for cloud storage. Amazon came out a couple of weeks ago and said that they're planning on spending $150 billion on data center construction before the end of this decade. So you would think that those players will absolutely win out of that. But the second part to this is that all companies either should or will be thinking about how can I use AI to improve the profitability of my business, what I can offer my customers, can I find new customers? And so over the next 5 to 10 years, I think every business will be positively or negatively affected. There'll be some businesses that will be decimated by AI because they will have difficult decisions to make about whether they disrupt themselves, which we saw, you know, in the early 2000s, or they try and keep going. But like, let's use Woolworths as an example, because I think Woolworths would be a business that many people wouldn't link to AI.
Yeah.
But let me give you something to think about. What if in 5 years' time, Woolworths said, we're going to start rolling out dynamic pricing? And so what I mean by that is that when you go into a Woolworths store and buy an avocado, you see that it's $1.50 on, you know, for today for on sale. What if that price is digital and it changed during the day to reflect demand and supply of what Woolworths, how many avocados Woolworths has got, and the ripeness of those avocados and how they're projecting those to go, and then
like
how many people?
Like a stock market at a supermarket.
Exactly. Yeah, and maybe so that's AI could create something like that. And a Woolworths could use a pricing solution like that to maximise its profits. It's not inconceivable. Or say I go into a Woolworths, if I watch this 15-second ad below the avocados, you can buy it for $1.15 on your rewards program. That's conceivable. They'll be able to manage the back-end logistics and storage. AI will help them make sure that they've got perfect levels of inventory, ideally, across their store networks. So, maybe this doesn't happen. Maybe this happens earlier. Maybe this happens later. But it's just something, you know, that they're the kind of things to think about. The other big thing will be the cost structure for many businesses. There'll be many businesses that find ways to take out headcount and replace that headcount with machines. If you can still sell the same number of products or services for the same prices, but your cost base is significantly lower, we could see a massive productivity leap happen, which could generate a profit leap. And that could be the thing that propels this bull market onwards as people start to price that in.
You didn't talk about Megaport, which I feel like has been, I guess, the investor favourite of this AI theme.
Yep.
What do you think of that stock?
Look, I don't follow Megaport closely. It's been a very volatile ride. And from what very good people behind it, from what I understand with the technology, that is a company that is directly exposed to AI spend and should benefit from it. The thing I'd say, so we own Goodman Group, and we increased our holding in Goodman Group when Greg Goodman really worded up the market about a year ago that it was going to push hard into data centres. We're skimming Goodman Group's holding at the moment because I feel like in the short term, the fundamentals of that business have disconnected. I feel like a lot of investors are trying to chase a very small number of stocks in Australia because of the AI trade. And I'd just be a bit wary about that because although those companies we listed and Megaport absolutely should benefit, it's just how quickly do those benefits flow and... You know, has the market just got a bit of ahead of itself in terms of the benefits that will come through in the medium term?
Okay. I want to turn now to Holy Grail stocks. In December last year, you told us that Brickworks was yours, a business with an impressive moat, a top-notch management team, and a rock-solid balance sheet. We've just seen Managing Director Lindsay Partridge announce he's retiring. The stock share price has fallen around 11% since hitting a new all-time high in early March.
Yep.
Is that still your holy grail stock? And if not, what would be?
Look, so it would still be one of them. I mean, I think I sort of signal that out because when I look at our core holdings, a number have run hard and probably are trading at the higher end of their valuation brackets that we've seen them trade at historically over long periods of time. So absolutely, it would still be a holy grail stock. I think the news that's come out since we last spoke about that was that Brickworks have reduced down, they've marked to market the value of their industrial property trust by around sort of 10%, which is a cyclical factor. And, you know, I think ultimately these properties over time will turn out to be more valuable than they are valued at the moment. And secondly, the building products division, which is actually a very small part of Brickworks overall business, is going through a pretty tough period at the moment. I would say Brickworks have called out, and I feel like there's growing evidence that we are looking forward at a once-in-a-generation house building boom. We need a lot more dwellings for all the people that have come to Australia and are going to come to Australia, and we have massively underinvested in this area for too long as a country. And it feels like a lot of, like, you know, in Sydney up here, certainly Chris Minns, the Premier, seems to really be beating his chest and staring down council, saying we need to get rid of red tape and get building going. So that could be, that headwind could turn into a tailwind. So absolutely, it would still be up there. You know, the bulk of the Brickworks business is actually Solpats. And Solpats is trading close to an all-time high as well. So, you know, that's good for them in terms of a read-through valuation. What's the holy grail stock at the moment? Do you want me to, is that a question down the track?
No, I'd love to know. If not Brickworks, what else are you liking right now as a holy grail stock?
Yeah, so, it kind of changes because, you know, I would look at WiseTech or REA, which I think are probably the two of the highest quality businesses. Altium would have been there as well, but that's now gone. Valuation-wise, you know, they've run hard and now's probably not the time to be calling them out. So, like, for me, it's probably CSL, which has really done nothing for 3 or 4 years now during the pandemic. And there's been reasons for that. But I also think the valuation has incrementally got cheaper and cheaper as each year's wearing on, but the business continues to grow its earnings, maybe not quite as fast as the market had expected them to. And from a valuation point of view, like, you know, you're paying 27 times forward earnings now for CSL. That, I would say, is at the lower end of its longer term sort of valuation band. And I think also a lot of the issues that they had during the pandemic, largely around margins in the blood collection business, in the bearing business, not rapidly, and it hasn't been as rapid as the market expected, but they are normalising. And so I think you can make a really good case there that the revenue from that business, which is kind of like the engine room of the business, could easily grow 8 to 12% per annum for the next 3 to 5 years. And if gross margins recover, which they've continued to forecast and reiterate they do see happening, if those margins improve back to normalised pre-pandemic levels on top of that, you're going to see 15% plus growth coming out of CSL each year for the next 3 to 5 years. And if you applied, you know, maybe an earnings multiple of 32 or something more mid-range for where it's normally been, you get a much, much higher share price in 3 to 5 years' time. So that for me, but, you know, like the Vifor acquisition, I think, has got question marks. They issued debt and equity to fund that. They've downgraded the revenue guidance from that division since they bought it. So I think there's some fundies looking at that going, not too sure. The CSL 112 unfortunately turned out to be a bust, which was seen as potentially a blockbuster drug coming through. So there's been some things that I think have held it back. But I think if you focus on the part of the business that will ultimately grow the earnings, the outlook's actually really good. And the valuation's good. So that would be the one probably at the moment.
Okay, before you talked about trimming your position in Goodman Group, are there any other stocks that you've been trimming recently or you've sold out of completely?
None we sold out of completely, but certainly, you know, that like selling, like managing money is, everyone's got their different processes, and the way that I've sort of morphed over time, or our business has morphed over time, is when is position size, you've got to be disciplined on position size. So if something really runs, you've got to be disciplined about just pulling that position back and making sure it's a sensible level. And also valuations. If things run and the valuations look a bit excessive in the short term, but you still think in the long term there's good reason to be there, trimming those positions, because it also gives you capital then to deploy into your CSLs, etc., which feel unloved, and potentially that's where the next five, you know, years of growth could be better. WiseTech would be, so actually there has been one stock we sold out of, which was Altium, but that was really a forced sale, but it was an extraordinarily good price. It's been absolutely our most successful investment we've ever made as a business. And that's given us quite a bit of capital to redeploy into other stocks. But we have been trimming WiseTech. We've been trimming a bit of REA. So although we still really like these businesses, it's just like making sure that if we think a WiseTech should be a 2 to 2.5% weighting on the Aussie equity component of someone's portfolio, if it goes to 3.5, or, you know, just regularly taking it and having money up your sleeve where these stocks do pull back hard sometimes, is being able to put money into those businesses when they're out of favour.
Where have you been putting that money to work? Or are you keeping, I guess, some dry powder on the sidelines?
Yeah, I think it's a combination, a bit of dry powder, but I think, you know, we invest in, I tend to end up, for whatever reason, talking about growth stocks a lot, but, you know, we're not all growth. Like, growth is a portion of our equity portfolio. You know, we've got what we think are great resource companies that we own, and et cetera. But we also, infrastructure has been an area we've long invested in and I think looks pretty well priced at the moment. Property, but Goodman Group would be one of the larger holdings there. But we also do quite a bit in listed debt. And so, you know, if I look back, if I look at where that money's sort of going now, it's into floating rate listed income securities, because you can still get 7.25 to 7.5% return from listed debt securities now, and these are listed by you know, really high quality businesses, namely the banks and insurers are the largest listers in the Australian market. And if I, you know, so in predominantly this is hybrids, right? And hybrids typically, there's been a bit of, what, for whatever reason, there's been some caution with hybrids, but if you look at the balance sheets of the businesses that are lending this capital or pulling this capital out, they've never been stronger. And I would say it's never been a better time to be a lender to some of these companies through these vehicles. So, you know, I'm kind of in the camp in Australia where, yes, we might get a rate cut or two over the next 12 months. It's not going to be significant. And the higher for longer case in Australia, I think, to me, unless data shows otherwise, it's still there. And if you're in floating rate, that means that the return should continue to be really attractive. So it's, I think, Ali, like, you know, the market's been strong, US market's been strong. Now's not a time to be beating your chest and thinking, you know, we want to, it's just continuing to refine what you've got, trimming the sails a bit in growth, and building up a little bit of a war chest that is paying you a nice income now. And if there is a pullback, you can deploy that cash and put it to work.
Are there any examples you could give there?
So probably the biggest one would be the Ramsay Healthcare preference shares, which are kind of they're a bit of an outlier in listed debt world. This gets a little bit technical and boring, so tell me if I'm veering off course too much. But so the code is RHCPA. And these were issued many years ago, pre-GFC, and they're actually a security that would not be issued in today's market. They were issued under different, I won't go into all the technicals, but different frameworks, pre-Royal Commission, and there's been a lot of changes to how these securities, what their T's and C's and stuff look like. So they pay a floating rate of 4.85% above the 90-day bank bill. And I think they're trading at about $105 at the moment. They've just gone ex a 6-monthly distribution. And that puts them on a yield of about 8.6-8.7%, backed by Ramsay Healthcare. Now, you know, often when you hear those sort of returns, you should be wary, because that's, I would say, a better return than you should expect for the security that is there. So, you know, what's the catch? What could go wrong? Like, the biggest thing that could be the catch is these get bought back. Okay, so if you're paying $105 and they get bought back, you're going to lose $5 in capital. So we've owned them for many years. So the longer that they don't get bought back, the better the return profile will look. I would say, when I look at Ramsay Healthcare at the moment, that they probably have a bit too much debt on their balance sheet. They will not be able to refinance these securities at a cheaper rate. Probably the one threat is a takeover and the acquiring party buying the debt on market. That would take at least a year to play out. So, you know, if you got an 8.7% return, but you ended up losing 5 in capital over a year, you'd still make an okay return. But if that doesn't happen this year, then you've got the 8.7, and year on year on year, it looks better and better and better and better. But we've owned these for a number of years now, and it's probably, I think, the best one.
Okay. I want to move to the end of the podcast now.
Okay.
Our final three questions for today. These are a little bit of fun, a bit of a thought experiment.
Yeah.
In your opinion, what is one thing investors are getting wrong about today's markets?
Okay, getting wrong, I would say they're too cynical. So in the start of a bull market, everyone's a bit wary. The general mentality is things have got too expensive. It's, you know, it's too early. Doesn't look great, you know, so taking money off the table, etc. In my mind, we are in America, as I said, it's a clearer pattern. We are probably 1 year into this next bull market. We had a very clear bear market in 2022. All the signs are there that we're early days. So we're just starting to see a bit of float activity. So we had the Reddit float, and we've had a couple of others coming on, but there's hardly a barrage of floats starting to come to the market. That still feels like it's early days. But we have a market retesting all-time highs, companies in an upgrade cycle in the blue chips, and we're just starting to see it feels like the money percolating down. So I know there's a lot of talk about Mag7, et cetera, but bull markets always start in the blue chip area of the market. And we've seen that in Australia as well. Clearly, there has been much better performance in the ASX 100 than the rest of the market. But that's classic dawn of bull market behaviour. And then you start to see the mids go, and then it's the smalls, and then it's the micros. And so it just feels to me like we're early days into the next cycle. But as always, you know, it's about making sure you've got the right amount of exposure to that, keeping that exposure at a sensible level, and being able to redeploy into it when you can.
Okay. Instead of asking you for a story of a big win or a big loss from your investing career, I'm going to touch on some of the points you raised in our last podcast with you in November 2021, when you were interviewed by my former colleague, Patrick Polk.
Yeah.
You told him that you were super bullish on the Afterpay block acquisition.
Mm.
That was probably the death knell for growth.
Yeah.
With 2022 obviously turning out to be a very difficult year for growth investors.
Yep.
What was the biggest takeaway from that year or that experience?
Yeah, I think I actually listened back to that the other day. So when we filmed that podcast, it was the very peak of the growth cycle. So the timing wasn't fantastic. But I actually think if you look back, that transaction was amazing for Afterpay shareholders. And it's not that Afterpay shareholders, which we were, made a whole lot of money on the back of it. It's just that I think there would have been a whole lot more downside if Afterpay hadn't been incorporated into Block. So what were the lessons that we took out of it? Firstly was, you know, because we were fairly early into Afterpay, I mean, I think it was like sub $10 when we started buying it. It was keeping that position size at a sensible level as it ran. You know, we did, I think at one point you look back and think, Jesus, if we shouldn't have sold a share, we would have made a lot of money. But continuing to skim that position and make sure that it was at the right point was good. The transaction, you know, I think when you look at what happened in hindsight, was overpriced script bought overpriced script. So for Block, look, I listened to their last earnings call. They are still adamant that the purchase of Afterpay, they would do it again if they'd had their time over. And they are still, you know, I know we've seen a lot of pain in the buy now, pay later space generally. They have spoken about Afterpay's growing at a very rapid pace inside the Block business, and that the bad and doubtful debts, which was the big question mark the market had when it was a solely listed vehicle, have stayed at historically low levels. And if I look at Block, so what have we done since? You know, we had that, so I would have said it was like a 2% or so weighting in Block / Afterpay, and we've been adding to it.
Recently?
Yeah. So Block has upgraded earnings twice in the last 12 months. At its last upgrade, it also upgraded FY25 earnings, and it's committed to meeting the Rule of 40. The Rule of 40 is seen as the gold standard in technology. So, you know, our team that we had also committed to meeting that. And what happens when, if you can do 40% sales revenue growth on 40% gross margins, the profitability goes absolutely berserk. And they've said that they're on track to do that. So, you know, you look at Block, it's trading on 18 times forward earnings. The EV to EBITDA is about 10. And they've got $7 billion in net cash. So, and they're in an upgrade cycle. So I think that they're in the growth area of the market. They're a growth stock that actually looks pretty good. So that's one that we've been chipping some money into on the four lower.
Xero also has just announced that they're going to be following that Rule of 40.
Yeah.
Do you feel similarly about that stock?
Yeah. So like and you know, you look back and Xero is another example. I think it got to $150 probably around that November 2021 time, fell to about 80. It's now, you know, sort of 125 or something now. So if a business can pull that off, I can tell you that the profit growth and the earnings multiple that is applied to that business expands significantly. And I think because we own Xero, and that is a business we've also had for some years now, the new CEO, I think, is doing a really good job at sharpening the focus on where they should invest capital, and being more conscious of the amount of capital that they're reinvesting back into the business and starting to let the profitability really run. And the market's applauding that because, you know, when I did the last podcast, everyone was valuing a bunch of companies on sales revenue multiples, and that time's gone for now, and who knows how long until it comes back.
Hopefully forever.
Profitability is cool again, it's important that CEOs don't stick to a pre-prescribed mentality, and they listen to markets and they adapt to that, and I think that's what we're seeing with the new CEO in Xero.
Okay, last question for today. In 2021, you told us that you would hold REA for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
It's obviously not really gone anywhere since then. Yeah. It's up around 4.5% since we recorded that podcast.
Yep.
You did just tell us that you were trimming your position in REA. It has run over the last 6 months.
Yeah.
Would you want to swap that out for a different stock for the next 5 years, or are you still backing REA as the one stock you would hold if markets were closed?
Yeah.
You know, for that period of time.
Yeah, look, I think I'd have CSL in there now just on based on what I've gone through before. But REA is still an incredibly good business. And again, it comes down to time frames, Ali. Like, you know, so I think we've owned REA for about 13 or 14 years now. And, you know, we were buying it somewhere around $15 or $16 when we started picking it up. And since then, we have continued to, you know, as that position size has risen, we've taken some off the table. And in 2022, we were adding to our holding in REA. So, you know, I think maybe that's just for the listeners. One thing, set and forget is great, and I'm all for keeping transactional turnover as low as you can, because I think transactional turnover is one thing that really eats into returns, unless, you know, I think for everyone, ultimately. The fund managers I see that have the same 10 top holdings as they did 5 years ago tend to win out, I reckon, over long term. And I could pull off numerous examples. But so you want to keep transactional turnover low. But in this part of a portfolio, I think you do. There is a case for being more active, and the case is that the ups and the downs tend to be much more significant, and you want to go a bit against the trend as they're happening. So taking a bit of money off into real strength, and when everyone's when value managers are punching the air and growth managers are, you know, really doing it tough, that's when you want to be pushing some money into that part of the market. So REA would absolutely, I can't see a case where we wouldn't want to own that for the next 5 years. But from a valuation perspective where it is today, there might be other stocks that do better. But it's hard to know. You know, if Australia does go out and build 1 million new dwellings over the next, by the end of this decade, which I think looks optimistic, but say it gets to 800,000 or 850,000, the market for REA has just expanded significantly. And then talk about AI. REA knows basically, you and I, it knows where we want to live because we've searched on it on their platform. It knows roughly what we can spend to live there. It knows what our houses are worth or what the house we're renting should be worth. It's got years and years of data, which it could create significant new business opportunities for it, where it further pushes into that space. And it's got a really good management team, which I'm sure, well, I know, are looking at how they can use AI to turbocharge what they do, what they offer to me as a customer or someone uses the platform, what they can offer to a seller, what they can offer to agents, and how that business looks in another 5 years, I think it's going to be really different to how it looks today.
Well, it's definitely an exciting time to be an investor. Thank you so much for joining us on the Rules of Investing today, Ben. It was awesome to speak with you today.
Thanks, Ali. Thanks for having me.